Today in meditation, I repeatedly exerted effort to bring my attention away from thoughts and back to the breath in the present moment. How is this not repeated acts of willpower? Unless I do this, the mind is completely unruly and can never become calm. A calm mind is needed to develop, needed for wisdom to arise. So why is willpower not as important as wisdom in tackling the defilements? Both seem to be vital and complementary in practice. Okay, so there is, I think, that, you know, the path of abandoning willpower is obviously a gradual one. It's not something you can abandon straight away. Willpower is, you move away from these things gradually. And the very fact that your mind is unruly and there's a lot of thinking going on means that you are using willpower already. It is the will that drives the thinking mind, right? If you didn't have any willpower, you wouldn't be thinking. It's actually the intention is there. You want to think, and that's why you think in the first place. So the willpower is already there. So the point here is to stop the thinking. You have to kind of withdraw the will. As you withdraw the will, that is actually how the thinking comes to an end. By using force and using effort to move your attention back to the breath, if it is very gentle, it's okay. And if it's very careful effort, it's usually all right, or can be okay. But the ideal way is just to sit back and just wait. And then when mindfulness arises, when mindfulness comes, when you see your thinking mind for what it is, then automatically the thinking already starts to calm down. Have you noticed that? Sometimes you get carried away by the stream of thought, right? Then mindfulness comes back. You're aware, I'm thinking. But as soon as you are aware of that, the thinking already is kind of declining, right? So you just wait, and you wait, and you just observe the thinking, and the thinking will calm down by itself, and then the breath comes back into your attention, back into view again. And when the breath comes back into view, well, then the attention is already there on the breath. You can see the difference there. So you don't actually really need, to exert any willpower to force the attention onto the breath. All you have to do is wait. And as you wait, it happens pretty much all by itself. Of course, in reality, there is going to be a little bit of effort there because we just can't help ourselves. We're so used to that. That's why we're trying to minimize it, to get away from the old habits, get away from using the will to always direct the mind, always force the mind around it. So this is usually how it works. And the reason why you think in the first place, this is also very interesting, right? The reason why we think is because we're not really content. We're not really happy. We want to think. Why do you want to think? Because because you haven't got enough happiness as it is in the present moment. So this is why it is so important to develop those other things, to develop techniques that reduce the defilements, right? We don't really have any craving. We don't really have any ill will towards anybody. Improve the reflections that give rise to this sense of happiness. And when you have that sense of happiness, it's automatically there. You don't want to think anymore because it gets in the way of the happiness. You have something else. And the intention to think subsides. And the mind becomes much more peaceful. Right? So it's an automatic process. And this is the most beautiful way of overcoming the thinking mind. And it's very natural. It's very easy. It's very relaxed. And you feel very good about the whole process when it happens in this way. And this is going to be a very important part of this retreat, is to look at how the Buddha explains how we move the mind away from the defilements towards the happiness of meditation practice. And there's very he explains this in quite a bit of detail in the suttas. So I hope that makes sense. Again, there isn't any complete abandoning of the will. I think that takes a long time, but you gradually try to move away from that. So just wait and see what happens. Just observe. And as you observe, as you are able to become the passive observer, that ability in itself reduces the thinking mind. Okay. So please, if I feel I haven't answered your questions properly, you can please just write another question tomorrow. This tends to be often kind of, it's very easy to have a bit of miscommunication about these things. So please please kind of try again next time. Okay, could you kindly please explain the meaning of the following words, volition and rapture? When these are difficult words in the suttas, please give the meaning. Okay. Yes, I did actually mention the meaning of volition during the talk. Volition is just the will, right? It's the active part in the mind, the thing which drives us all the time. When you decide to lift your hand, that's the volition in the mind that decides to lift the hand. It's the will inside which does makes the movement happen, right? This is volition. Volition is what does all the movement, whether physical, when you speak, or even when you think. It's all driven by the will. The will, this is what volition is. So I think sometimes what happens is that the suttas, it's true that sometimes these words are a little bit difficult, and I think one reason for that is that the person who has translated many of the suttas, he's a philosopher. He has a PhD in philosophy. This is Venerable Bodhi. And I think sometimes you get a bit out of touch with kind of ordinary vocabulary when you have a PhD in philosophy. So you use words that are very kind of heavy words. Sometimes you have to have a dictionary next to you when you're reading Bhikkhu Bodhi's introductions and that sort of thing. Yeah. Volition. Volition is the word. Volition is the one that he used in the first sutta we talked about this morning. It just means will, right? It means the will which decides that you want to do things. That's what volition means. So. And rapture, the word rapture is just a state of happiness, right? It's a state of kind of joy and bliss, but it's often the way, this is the piti in Pali. Piti is what is translated as rapture into English. And it is this thing which often has a very kind of strong physical component as well. You can feel the rapture kind of sometimes flowing through the body, right? It's kind of this exhilaration almost going through you. And this is what is meant by rapture. And most people who meditated for a while will have had these kind of experiences happening to them. And it starts to get very pleasant when you start to feel these things, right? You start to get some of the benefits of meditation practice. Okay, well, thank you for asking that question. It's good to get these things clarified. So if there are other words like that, please ask, and I will clarify these things as we go along. Okay. Next one. Okay, dear Ajahn, how do we do metta meditation or cultivate our metta if we are not touched by children, animals, or anything around us? If a person has little imagination and not able to put forward an image to build their metta, what can they do as an alternative? Okay, it doesn't take much imagination to have metta, right? Metta, what is metta? Well, metta is just the focusing on anyone, people or animals or whatever, and just remembering the good qualities in those people or those animal or whatever it is. That's what metta is. And on a retreat like this, it's not that hard, right? You're surrounded by all these wonderful people here, people who would, you know, who have practiced Buddhism for a long time and kept the precepts and have good intentions. Not perfect people, but so much goodness that if you just focus on that goodness, wow, it is just amazing, it's wonderful. And then because you see the goodness in the people around you, it doesn't have to be people around you, it can be anyone really, but you know, it could be those around you. When you see that goodness, then you can wish them well, right? You think inside of yourself, may you be well, may you be happy. And when you see the good qualities in somebody, it is not, maybe not easy, but it's much easier then to have a sense of goodwill towards those people. So try that. Try whoever you feel that you have some positive perception towards. Those are the people that you should have metta towards. That is where the metta can arise. Don't try to have metta towards those people you don't like, because that's going to make it very, very hard. Sometimes we say that we have metta towards the enemy, right? It's kind of the idea of metta. You start with the people you like, then you go to the neutral people, then you have metta for the enemy. You never really have metta to the enemy. What happens is that as you do the metta, you learn to see the good qualities in everybody. That's what happens. So he or she was an enemy before you started metta, but once you have metta, of course, they're not an enemy anymore, right? You have given up this idea of somebody being an enemy. So that's metta, seeing the goodness in somebody else and then wishing them well. So wherever you can see that goodness, that's where you should direct your metta meditation to get it going. According to the Visuddhimagga, the famous commentary work in Theravada Buddhism, one should start with oneself. So if you have a very good sense of self-esteem and you truly think that you are a wonderful person, which probably is true, right? You probably are a wonderful person. Then you start with yourself and think, may I be happy, may I be well. That's a wonderful thing to be able to do that to yourself. And then you can take it from there and then to the whole rest of the world. Okay. Dear Ajahn Brahmali, does a nimitta arise only when the breath and the body disappears? There isn't any kind of absolute standard for when nimittas arise and when they don't arise. Nimittas can arise in many different places. When the nimittas arise, you can sometimes still have a little bit of feeling of the body or even the breath, like in the background, right? But the nimitta is like the main thing. Sometimes when the nimitta becomes very powerful, the body and the breath will disappear completely. That's usually what happens. But there is no absolute standard here. It's only when you go into jhana, only when you go into very deep meditation, that the body disappears absolutely 100% and the breath disappears 100%. Before that, there's still a bit of overlap, right? You can still perhaps hear a little bit of sounds and all these kind of things. There is no absolute distinction there. Nimittas come in many qualities, right? They can be like weak nimittas that are not very bright. But then you get very bright and very powerful nimittas, and those very powerful nimittas, they're the ones that make the breath vanish and everything disappear. Dear Bhante, why does the Buddha use the term middle way to describe the path? From my understanding, sensual desire and self-mortification are two sides of the same coin, right? Yeah. When walking the Eightfold Path, one abandons the whole coin, so to speak. They use the term middle way. Many thanks. Yes, I would agree with that. They are in many ways two sides of the same coin, and the reason for that is because it is all to do with the body, right? The body is a problem. Either you get happiness through the body or you get pain through the body. So both are involved with the world of the five senses, the world of sensuality. And the middle way is actually the moving away from sensuality. So it is true. And I think the reason why it is called the middle way is more for, because remember the Buddha, up to the time of his awakening, he had lived a very comfortable life at home, kind of taken sensual pleasures to the maximum possibility in those days almost by living a very comfortable life. And then he had done the opposite, which was the spiritual norm in those days, and that was to mortify the body. So in a sense, those were possibly two extremes as seen from the viewpoint of people in India in those days, the extreme of just indulging yourself and having a good life at home, and the other extreme of mortifying the body, doing painful penance to try to overcome the sensuality in that way. So I think that's why it is called the middle way. So the middle way is, you're quite right, it's in one sense it's actually the Buddha's path, which is the extreme, and the two others kind of the same side of the coin. I would tend to agree with that. So what is that middle way? And the middle way, of course, is the Eightfold Path, which culminates in Satipatthana and then the jhanas afterwards, right? So it's the spiritual happiness that is really what the middle way is. The joy, the rapture, the piti, the sukha, that's where it all lies. Okay. Dear Ajahn, could you please explain again the elimination of coarse defilements by a layperson, especially how meditation helps in that process? Thank you. Okay, so the elimination of defilements is the cause of defilements is the speech, right, and also the bodily actions, and also the coarsest aspects of the mental actions. The coarsest aspects of the mental actions, that which drives the bad bodily and speech, that also has to be abandoned. And the way that meditation helps that is that when you just do a little bit of meditation every day, you have a bit more peace, right? You have a bit more compassion, a bit more metta, a bit more time for the people around you. And because you feel good about yourself, because you have more peace, you have all these qualities inside, it means that when you go out, it's easier to live a virtuous life, to be a kind, to live a kind life. This is not the kind of deep meditation yet, but nonetheless, it is something which helps you to move in the right direction. So just, you know, even if you just have a few minutes every day, I'm sure many of you here are extremely busy in your daily lives, but even if you can just do 10 minutes of meditation every day, just to kind of close your eyes and allow things to settle down a bit, right? Close your eyes and just remind yourself of all the goodness in this world. When you read too much newspapers, you get really depressed because all you get all the digest of all the worst disaster in the world, kind, straight into, whoa, this is terrible, this place. But actually, there's so much goodness in the world as well. It's never written about in the newspapers, so you have to come to retreats like this to find out that there is such goodness in the world. So remember that, and when you remember that, it lifts your spirits, and then you wish those people well, right? And this is how you then sustain your ability to remove those negative defilements through a little bit of meditation, a little bit of peace every day. It doesn't have to be much. Sometimes we raise the bar too high and we think, okay, I'm going to meditate 1 hour every day. If you can do that, wonderful, of course, that's great. But don't raise the bar too high. Start at a very low level. Start with something you can do. 10 minutes is great. And then if over time you can increase that, that's wonderful too. Okay. Hi, Bhante. I know someone who is a great meditator. He claims to be one anyway, it says here, but behaves badly, rude, not gentle in his speech of body and mind. How do we explain this situation? Is it possible that he has reached level 1 or level 2 of jhana? Thank you. okay. There's many different things here which first of all, it is very uncertain. The things that other people claim is always incredibly uncertain. People have a tendency to overestimate themselves. One of the things that I remember from the suttas is where the Buddha, all these people come up to the Buddha and say, oh, you know, I have attained the final liberation of mind. And then somebody who sits nearby, they hear all these people coming up and say that they have attained the final liberation. And then they ask the Buddha, well, how many of these actually have? You know, have all of these attained final liberation? Or some of them not, and some of them have? What actually is the story? And the Buddha says, of all these people who say these things, some actually have attained liberation, and some have not, right? This was at the time of the Buddha. This was at the time when you had the greatest teacher around, who would have had that liberation himself. The teachings probably were very clear, they had the best possible advice, and still they overestimated themselves. So in the present day, it is extremely likely that people will tend to overestimate their attainments. So when people say this thing, take it with an incredible pinch of salt. Don't believe these things outright. And especially if their behavior is bad and rude and all those kind of things, the chances are that they are overestimating themselves, and maybe it's coming from ego, perhaps even, I don't know, just a guess. It's certainly possible, and then it is quite unlikely. But it is also possible. It is not entirely impossible that somebody who is rude actually can attain these things, because a lot of the reason why we can attain things like deep samadhi has to do with conditions also in the past lives, right? This person may have been an angel in the past life, a beautiful person, right? With all these wonderful qualities. And then in this life, they have had the wrong company, been around the wrong people, so they have become rude. But because of the power of the actions in the past life, they are able to still attain some of that deep states of meditation even in this life. So it's possible, it can happen. But what will happen to this person in the future is that their ability to attain these states will decline, go down and go down over time, until eventually there's nothing left of that ability. So they're heading in the wrong direction, right? And remember that in the Buddha's teaching, it is not what we attain that is the most important thing. It is not actually the states that we can get that really matters. What matters is that we're heading in the right direction. That is the important thing. Because then there is a chance of improving. Then there's a chance of eventually attaining the state of Nibbana even, if we keep on going in the right direction. But if you are going downwards, then there's no way that you're going to... You're losing ground, right? You're not going to go anywhere. So that actually what matters is where we're going and not where we're at right now. And that is expressed very nicely. There is a sutta which is kind of, some people find a bit puzzling. You find it in the Anguttara Nikaya. And there's this, the Buddha, he's walking around and he, first of all, he sees this monk. This monk is, some of you have probably heard this before, this monk is sitting on the, just next to a village, right? Or even maybe within the village. And he's sitting very straight, right? Very impressive. Looks like he's sitting in samadhi, very, very peaceful and very quiet. And then the Buddha says, and this is the sort of thing you perhaps wouldn't expect, but the Buddha says, I'm not happy with that monk. You know, this monk displeases me. Why is that? Because sooner or later he will be disturbed. And when he's disturbed, he will be pulled away from that samadhi, and he will lose ground, and he won't be able to meditate anymore. Sometimes we think that what matters is, you know, it doesn't matter so much whether you live in the village or in the forest, as long as your meditation is good. That's not what the Buddha says. The Buddha says it matters where you live, because it's about where you're heading, where you're going, and not where you're at right now. And then the Buddha goes into the forest, and he sees a monk in the forest. A monk who's nodding, right? Tired, no energy in the mind. But he's sitting in the forest, far away from the village. And the Buddha says, that is my kind of monk. He's doing the right thing. Again, very fascinating, because you think he might say, you know, you, what are you doing? You're sitting there nodding away. But the Buddha says instead, no, because he's sitting in the right place, because he's heading in the right direction, he will be able to overcome that tiredness, and then his meditation will take off, and he will be going in the right direction. It's very fascinating, isn't it? It's all about the conditions, knowing the conditions that are suitable for progress into the future. That is what matters. So this is what this person has missed out on, hasn't understood what the conditions are for future progress. And this person is going to decline and decline and decline. So because of that, have a sense of compassion for this person. They don't know what they're doing. Even though they're claiming to have good states of meditation, they're actually on a downward path. Okay, can you give a brief introduction to Satipatthana? Is it a process or a state? Okay, so Satipatthana is, you know, we have the Noble Eightfold Path, and we have there's obviously eight factors. The seventh factor of that path is called Sammasati. Sammasati means right mindfulness. And Sammasati is defined as Satipatthana. So Satipatthana is what we do as a seventh factor of the Noble Eightfold Path. So before you get to that, you have to do all the other six, the first six factors first, right? Then you get to Satipatthana, and then you get to Sammasamadhi, the jhanas after that. So what is Satipatthana? Satipatthana is basically meditation. That's basically what it is. Quite literally, it means something like attending with mindfulness, or focusing the mindfulness. That's what it means. So the prerequisite of Satipatthana practice is that you already have mindfulness present. If you read the Satipatthana formula, it says that one of the words that is in the formula is Satima. Satima means having mindfulness, right? So to be able to do Satipatthana practice, you have to have mindfulness already. And people don't often realize that. Sometimes it is translated as the foundations of mindfulness into English. But the translation foundations of mindfulness give this idea that we are using Satipatthana to create mindfulness, right? That's the idea it gives. But actually, according to the Satipatthana formula itself, That's not what it means. What it means is how we use mindfulness. You have to already have mindfulness fairly well established before you can do satipatthana practice. So once the mindfulness is there, and the reason for that is because once the mindfulness is there, then it is possible to attend to any object you like. You place your mindfulness on the object, and then it sticks there because your mindfulness is already present. So satipatthana is not so much a method to give rise to mindfulness, but how we use mindfulness. And then, once mindfulness is established, you use satipatthana, and the reason why we use this satipatthana practice is to overcome the very last refined defilements of the mind. You will see that, for example, you see in the Vedanupassana is the contemplation of feelings, is the understanding of the bad feelings and the good feelings, right? So you want to overcome the bad ones and move to the good ones. The Chittanupassana, the contemplation of the mind, there is the bad mind states and the good mind states. We want to move towards the good ones. The Dhammanupassana is like the contemplation of Dhamma. It's a bit controversial what the word Dhamma actually means, but it means perhaps something like principles, perhaps, or something like that. And in Dhammanupassana, you're learning about the five hindrances, the very refined aspects of the hindrances, how to overcome them, what causes them, what establishes them in the mind, how to get rid of them, how they stay away from the mind in the future. You're coming to understand your mind in the most refined sense of the five hindrances. So this is what's happening here. Satipatthana is all about this, understanding the mind, understanding the hindrances, and then through that process, abandoning them all the way down to the very last and most refined aspects of these hindrances. That's what it's about. And that's why satipatthana is the seventh factor on the Noble Eightfold Path. And then the eighth factor is samma samadhi. Satipatthana leads to samadhi in the Noble Eightfold Path. You abandon the hindrances, then you use satipatthana to focus the mind, and when the mind is focused enough, you will enter the state of samadhi, right? The easiest way to understand satipatthana is just to understand it as mindfulness of breathing. It says in the sutta that you complete and you fulfill the satipatthana practice simply by watching your breath, right? According to the sutta, that's all you have to do is watch your breath. It's very, very nice and easy, isn't it? Just watch your breath and you become enlightened. That's quite literally what the suttas say here. So, wonderful news, isn't it? You don't have to worry too much about all these difficult instructions. All you do is watch your breath. Of course, we all know that's not all. It's kind of a simplification of things. We find it hard to watch the breath, and for that reason, the reason for that, of course, is all the defilements, etc. But actually, when it comes down to it, the path is very, very simple. All you have to do really is watch the breath. There isn't anything more to it. So just keep watching the breath. Learn about watching the breath. Do that, and that will take you all the way to awakening. You don't have to be a genius to understand the Buddhist path. It's actually very simple. The only reason it's hard is because there are mental obstacles inside of us that have to be overcome for the path to flow on nicely and smoothly. So satipatthana is a process. It is a process of eliminating the defilements and moving into jhana. That's what it basically is all about. It's not a state. The jhanas, that's when you're talking about states. At this point, you're still talking about a process. Okay, how do we know ourselves or our defilements if we practice virtuous conduct? How to stop the defilements? Thank you. Okay, so one of the points here is that by practicing virtue, by being kind, that this is actually a way of overcoming the defilements, right? If you are kind to other people, if you always think, I have to try to be kind, what that means is that sometimes you don't feel like being kind, right? I don't feel like being kind to this person, sometimes it feels like that. So that means that you have to change your perspective. because you know that you want to be kind to other people, but sometimes you don't feel like it. You have just to ask yourself, well, why don't I feel like it? Can I change my perspective? Can I perhaps be kind even though I don't feel like it, right? So the idea of kindness and practicing virtue actually means that you're already, by doing that much, you're already undermining the defilements of the mind. You're already purifying yourself. But the most powerful way of overcoming the defilements is later on, is actually to work directly with your mind. And this is the opportunity you have on a meditation retreat like this. You look at your mind, you start to understand what your problems are, what are the things that are causing difficulties for me in my meditation practice. And then you start to work with that directly. And this, again, is going to be a major theme of this retreat, is how can we work with the mind to undermine the problems in the mind. And of course, once the mind is kind of established in a wholesome way, once there is a sense of metta and compassion and peace in the mind, once you know how to direct the mind in the right way, then it's very easy to be virtuous, right? It's very easy to be kind, because you want to be kind. You want to do what is right. You don't feel like being angry and doing bad things to other people. You want to be a kind person. So it's very powerful to work with the mind, because it makes the whole thing run much more smoothly afterwards if you do that. But I will be talking lots about this during this retreat, how to overcome defilements, etc. Okay, dear Ajahn, how to become a virtuous person if around us, especially family, it's easy to get angry. Sometimes I try to tell them and we end up with an argument. Okay, is it right action if I choose to be silent, whatever they say? And how to be kind, gentle, and let it be to ourselves? Thank you, with metta. Okay. Yes, it is challenging to always be kind. It is challenging sometimes as a monk to always be kind, right? To always say the right thing is quite difficult. And this, I know that it's much more difficult in family life than it is in monastic life, because in monastic life you have more space. In family life you have people around you all the time, right? It's like when I go back and visit my family, I'm going back in October, I know that all the old defilements, they start surfacing again, right? You're around your parents, you're around your brother and sister, around all your family members, and they tend to trigger your defilements, just like they did 20 years ago or whatever when I was there. This is just the nature of family, right? There are certain ingrained things that are so ingrained, it's very difficult to actually get out of the groove. I must admit, it's getting a bit better after 20 years, but still there's a little bit lingering thing there after all that time. So with family, is that you have to, again, you just have to be very patient with yourself, and you have to take time, and you just have to learn, just like everything else, you have to learn to look at your family members in a new way. You have to be more understanding. You have to know that your family members, whether they are your parents, whether they are a partner, a husband or a wife or a partner, whether they are your children, or whatever they are, you have to always remember that they have defilements, right? They have problems, they have difficulties in life, just like us. And you have to learn to understand them. You have to learn to understand that even though they do things that you don't like, it's not because they want to hurt you. It's just because their habits, their way that they have whatever has happened to them in this life have made them have this kind of habit, this kind of way of doing things in the world, that they can't help themselves. They have to act in this way. And when you start to understand that people are the way they are, not because they want to hurt you, or because they want to be bad, or because they want to be evil or whatever, but simply because of the habits that are so ingrained, you can start to forgive them, right? And always remind yourself, always look at yourself, and remember how hard it is to change yourself. When you say to yourself, I would like to change, right? We all would like to change, we all like to be more perfect, how easy is it? And your family is a very good mirror in that respect. You go back to your family, you make a determination. Okay, I've been on a 9-day retreat, I feel really peaceful and nice now, so when I go back, I will be able to be much nicer to your family. That's what you think, right? And then you go back, and after a couple of days, it's all back to the old way it was again before. So you have to be very, very patient, and you have to, because the habits are so ingrained. So know yourself, first of all. know how hard it is to change yourself. See how you tend to fall back into the old patterns. Once you see that, you can forgive other people for falling into their old patterns and for doing the same thing that they are always doing. And in this way, you're actually removing yourself from your habits and your bad habits in regard to your family. But again, don't put the bar too high. Don't ask impossible things of yourself. Be kind to yourself as well. Know, understand the limitations in yourself. Know how conditioned you are. This is one of the things you can observe on this retreat, how conditioned you are and how difficult it is to move away from that conditioning. And when you see how conditioned you are, you can be compassionate to yourself. You can think, wow, it is so hard to do these things. I'm doing my best, but boy, it is difficult. And then you can have compassion, and you don't become so critical of yourself when you fail. This is always one of the downfalls of a spiritual path, that we become critical of ourselves when we fail. Please don't be critical. Be happy that you're even trying. That is the miracle, right? Somebody is actually trying to be better. That is the wonderful thing. So be thankful to yourself that you are trying so hard, to the best of your ability, to change and move in the better direction. Then have compassion on your family. Understand that they do the things they do, not because they want to upset you or anybody else, but simply because they have been conditioned to be what they are. In this way, you can start to change your perspective. These are very simple little things, but they're incredibly powerful things. Incredibly powerful because they take away so much of the sense of self. It's the sense of self which underlies judgment. We judge people because we think that they're doing this, because they want to do this, and we forget that actually there is no underlying sense of self there. There is a sense of self, there is no underlying self. There's just this conditioned phenomena called the five aggregates. And this is all there is. And they're always moving around according to conditions. Okay, dear Ajahn, can you give the main Pali words in Anguttara AN 11.2, volition, like virtue and sila, etc. The main Pali words in Anguttara 11.2. So volition is chaitana, right? Chaitana, you all heard about chaitana, C-E-T-A-N-A, right? This is when the Buddha says that kamma is chaitana. He says kamahang chaitana vadami or something like that. So kamma is chaitana. That is the word there. And non-regret, this is called avipatisara. Vipatisara is regret, and this is the negative, avipatisara. And then you have pamudja. Pamudja is the gladness or the joy that comes from not having any regret. Pamudja is a very important term in the suttas. From the pamudja comes the piti. The piti is the rapture, right? From the rapture comes the tranquility. Tranquility is pasadi in Pali. Pasadi. From pasadi comes what Bhikkhu Bodhi translates as pleasure. Usually translated as happiness is sukha. Sukha, happiness. From sukha comes samadhi, translated as concentration by Venerable Bodhi. From samadhi comes the yata bhuta jnana dasana, knowledge and vision, seeing and knowing things according to reality. From that comes nibbida. Nibbida is this sense of pushing away of the world, disenchantment, or even repulsion, being repelled by the world because you see it's all suffering. Nibbida. From nibbida comes viraga. Viraga is a fading away of desire, fading away of craving. Craving disappears, viraga. And then from viraga comes vimutti. Vimutti is liberation. That is the whole sequence in Anguttara 11.2. Okay, so I hope that helps. Sometimes you can check that in the Pali books. Okay. Wow, okay. So, Ajahn Brahmali, on the precept that one shall not sleep on a high bed, I once heard a teacher explain as follows. This teacher went on to explain on the language is used in the translation, interpretation of the Buddhist text during the different periods. And that when one shall not sleep on the high bed, first appears during X period, which I cannot recall now, and that it should not be taken literally, the meaning of high bed. It was a language at that time period to refer to a high luxurious chair as bed. And it means something along the lines that one should not covet or sit on some high ranking position in society. Okay, I'm not sure how true this is, and what I recall may not be exactly what I heard some time back. But this explanation makes a lot of sense, rather than why high beds are not allowable. Just want to share this with Mette. Okay, it actually means a high bed. I don't think there's any doubt about that, because it says that in the suttas for this particular precept, it says that not only should you not sleep on a high bed, but you should have a little mat, right? Like a little straw mat. That's kind of the ideal bed in those days. So a little straw mat cannot refer to the position in society. That must refer to what you're actually lying or sitting on, right? So I'm pretty sure that this actually means that. But the point, as you say, is not so much of whether the bed is high or low. The point is whether the bed is luxurious. So usually a high bed would also be a luxurious bed. If it was high, it would also have all these coverlets and all these pillows and all these kind of things, right? So it was both luxurious and high at the same time. But the height of the bed is not really, as you say, it's not really the issue. It doesn't matter so much, as long as it is reasonably simple, and it is just enough for, you know, getting enough sleep at night. That is what really is all about. So the point here is not to indulge, but to find, just find in the right amount of sleep to be able to do the meditation practice. Okay. So how will the past affect a person's thinking and behavior? So how will the past affect the person's thinking and the behavior? It will affect it completely, right? Almost completely. There's nothing. We are all victims of the past. We're victims of the past in this life. When you just watch what you are thinking, it is usually about somehow related to the past very often. And if it isn't related to the past, it's related to the future. And how you regard the future is conditioned by your past, right? You think about the future in a certain way because you have a certain past history. So everything is kind of, we are the victims of the past. We are trapped by our past. And we can't really step out of that conditioning. And that is why it is so important that we try to, in the present moment, to get into the present moment and just be aware of what's happening here. And then we are reducing that conditioning from the past. And by reducing that, we can refocus. We can start to look at things in a new way. And when we look at things in a new way, that is when we are reconditioning the mind in the present moment. Right now, we're looking at things in a new way. And that reduces some of that being trapped in the past that we usually are. So this is what we're trying to do here, trying to refocus the mind to kind of step out of our conditioning, step out of our kind of prison that we carry with us all the time. Ajahn, can you please give more detail and examples of non-regret? Is it okay to know one has done a misdeed, then regret it, then aim to do better, maintaining acceptance throughout? Thank you. Yes, that is. It is certainly, if you have done a mistake, and everybody makes mistakes, right? So that's the first of all, is just to say, okay, I made a mistake, it's no big deal. And the definition of perfection in virtuous and moral behavior in the suttas is not that you keep your precepts perfectly. Even the Aryas, even people who are on the path to awakening enlightenment, make mistakes. And they sometimes break their precepts. So even the Aryas do this. How much more ordinary people do these kind of things? But what the Aryas do, what a noble person does, if you have reached a stage of awakening, they will straight away confess the fact that they have made a mistake, right? They will confess it straight away. Because when you confess it to somebody else, it means that you're open about things. And you know that the very act of confession is going to restrain yourself in the future. So you confess, and then the monastic formula for this is what we do as monastics. If you make a mistake, you go to confess to one of the other monks, and then you say, part of the formula of confession that you say is that I will restrain myself for the future. So the purpose of confession is actually to get rid of that fault and then to help yourself in restraining in the future. So that can be a good thing to do, right? If you have a good friend and you think you want to confess and you want to sort of say, okay, but I want to try harder in the future, that can actually be a useful thing to do. So, and then, of course, yes, you will have less regret, right? Because you are doing this. So the idea of non-regret is just watch what happens in your mind. Watch what happens in your mind when you do something bad. And what you will see in your mind, it kind of darkens the mind. It makes the mind more dull. It loses its brightness. It loses its buoyancy and lightness when you do something bad. When you do meditation, you made a mistake, you have said something wrong to somebody, and you try to meditate afterwards, the mind feels a bit heavy. It doesn't feel light anymore. It hasn't got that brightness. And that is part of what we mean by regret in this particular case. So non-regret is when instead of having done something wrong, you've done many good things, and all you're able to do is remember all the goodness, right? Then the mind is freed of that heavy weights of darkness, the heavy weights that hold the mind down, and then the mind kind of floats up by itself. This is what is meant by non-regret, that mind which is very free from all those things that hold it down in this way. And it manifests in many ways. The most, sometimes it manifests like, oh no, I shouldn't have done that. Other times it doesn't manifest that clearly. It is just this feeling inside of you which holds you down in a sense. So watch your mind. And once you watch your mind and you can see how these things work, you will get an understanding of what regret and non-regret means in this context. Okay, so the last question for tonight. Does all gradual training start with virtue? Here some sequences start with suffering, etc. Suffering. Okay. Yes, there are different sequences of, it's not actually the gradual training, this what I'm talking about here is more what is sometimes called dependent liberation. It's this idea of the sequence of one causal thing leading to something else. And there is one place where it starts with suffering. Yes, it doesn't actually start with suffering even, it actually starts with ignorance. It starts with avidya. And then it goes through the whole sequence of dependent arising, ignorance to sankhara, right? In other words, these volitional, willed activities, all the way up to suffering. Dependent origination is what shows you that suffering is founded on ignorance, founded on avidya. That's what dependent origination shows you. But then there's one sutta known as the Upanishad Sutta, which shows you what happens next. Because of suffering, you gain faith, right? When people, the Buddha says, the two things happen when people suffer. Either they get really deluded. Delusion becomes very powerful. You don't know what you're doing anymore. You lose your sense of reality almost. And of course that can happen when you suffer, because it's just too painful and too difficult. Either that can happen, or you gain faith. You start searching. You're searching for a liberation, for a way out of this. And that is when you're looking around, okay, and then you come to the Buddha's teachings, and the Buddha says, there is a problem, there is suffering, and there is a way out. And you think, yeah, okay, this is interesting. This is what I've been looking for. And then when you look at that teaching and you see that it makes sense and there is a reasonable path out of suffering, that's when you gain confidence, right? Sometimes we use this word faith. I don't think the word faith is very useful. But you gain confidence in these teachings of the Buddha, that there's something to these teachings. So yes, there is this sequence which starts with faith. And then that faith leads to the same steps that we're talking about today. Because faith is very powerful. If you have very strong confidence in something, that also makes the mind beautiful. That also frees you from defilements in a similar way that virtue does. When you remember the Buddha and you feel, wow, this Buddha, this teacher is just amazing. This Dhamma is so powerful. That creates a very wholesome mind state. And this is why the idea of the recollection of the Buddha Dhamma Sangha, this is one of the recollections in the suttas that is recommended to people, because it purifies your mind. But But often you have to do both. For most people, we have to have both confidence in the teachings and we have to have virtue. We need both aspects to really be able to make the path come alive. So it's not one or the other. And not just that, but it is the sequence which starts with virtue that is by far the most important one. That is the one you see again and again in many different suttas. The one with faith, I think, is only found in one particular place. So virtue is the one. We can always do something with virtue. Confidence is a bit more difficult to deal with, but virtue, kindness, our character, how we think, how we look at the world, how we act, we can actually do something with that. Confidence is more difficult. It takes more time often. Okay, very good. So those are the questions for tonight. We will meet and see you again tomorrow morning. So have a nice night. Enjoy yourself. And we'll see you then.